Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 747.JE0708, certificate number 45939. Magic Alex.
Hello, I'm Alexis from Apple Electronics. I would like to say hello to all my brothers around the world and to all the girls around the world and to all the electronic people around the world. That is Apple Electronics.
I guess I should be clear that we're recording this entry immediately after we recorded the previous entry about Saul's Ants, but specifically about Creedence Clearwater Revival. And I had no idea that we were doing so much boomer culture back to back.
Yeah, Magic Alex, I know this story pretty well. And when I saw it, when we talked about it, when you walked in the door, I was like, huh. Good thing my Saul Zantz episode is coming before your boomer pedantry.
Well, it's not just a late 60s band. It's the breakup of an iconic late 60s band. I feel like we are not cementing our reputation as a forward-thinking Gen Z-friendly show with back-to-back record production episodes, but this was a request.
What do you think? What if we franchise Omnibus and get like a couple of young people to do one that's just like, and today's episode is on another cool meme about the one where the person is dancing and then the cat jumps on them and they fall.
Young blue-haired people, please reach out. We are looking for two hosts.
You should be like funny and cool, but like also like really edgy and real, but also like, I don't know, just like chill and not sus.
No, all of them. Yeah. Do not be sus. Mm-mm.
Zero amount of sus.
Please don't be binary.
No. How much sus do you think you are?
I think I'm pretty sus.
Really?
Yeah.
What about you is sus?
I'm a little cagey.
Yeah, that's right. You are. Yeah.
Cagey was our word for sus back before we didn't have Among Us.
You know, the thing about me is that I'm an open book. The problem is everything about me is sus. So I'm an open book. I'm not cagey at all, but I'm super duper. I'm soup dupe sus, as we would have said.
You need to be cageier.
Yeah.
And I need to be more open about my, about how I want to buy the world a Coke.
Yeah, but I don't think you do.
That's correct. That is correct. Get your own damn Coke. We haven't done, so the show was requested by a listener named Jack, and I thought it was a great idea.
That's a fake name, though. Nobody under 55 is named Jack.
Maybe he's over 55. He did request a show about late era Beatles.
Okay, right. That could be.
But Magic Alex kind of had a burst of visibility recently for a Greek man who's been dead for 6 years, considered for his appearance
in the Beatles doc.
In the Peter Jackson documentary, Get Back. Have we done, you know, we've done close to 200 shows about the Beatles.
Yeah.
Have we, despite this not being a Beatles podcast, did we ever talk about the Beatles after Get Back came out?
Well, the problem is, you know, Roderick on the Line, my original podcast, we for a long time described the show as being about the Beatles and Hitler, because Merlin and I used to just call each other and yell about the, he would yell at me about the Beatles. And then I would say, well,
you have to understand,
listen, here's, let's bring this back to Hitler. But when Get Back came out, Merlin, my co-host of that show, Merlin Mann, was, I don't know what was going on that day, but we watched the show and we came on, I came on ready to talk about Get Back.
Because watching Get Back makes you want to talk about nothing but Get Back for 8 hours.
Oh, it was incredible.
I've had no new Beatles takes for a decade, and suddenly I have nothing but Beatles takes.
Nothing but new Beatles takes. And I think what it was there was so much to say that it overwhelmed him. And we spent that whole episode talking about Fresh Fruit or something. Never talked about it. Never got back to talking about it.
And that's what Hitler's for.
And I was, I was for a while a member of the Beatles group, the Maria Semple organized Beatles talking group.
Yeah, you talked about how Michael Lindsay Hogg came on.
And so we talked to Michael Lindsay Hogg about Get Back before Get Back came out and heard all of his hot takes about it. But since Get Back has come out, I have at no point had an opportunity to lay out my foot-thick hot takes.
Oh, no.
And now here you are. A bird in the headlights.
With what I thought was an hour-long
omnibus
entry.
You're like, let's talk about Magic Alex. And I'm like, I've got my scimitar just...
We got to talk about the microphone and the teapot.
Just sharpening it, ready to talk about Yoko. I've got 6 hours of Yoko content that I'm like a teapot on the stove. Whee! And no one has asked.
I feel like Peter Jackson mutes Yoko in that documentary. You see her talking more in Let It Be than you do in Get Back.
Yeah.
Dialogue is specifically omitted.
But there were so many Yoko hot takes from 1970 to 2000.
Yeah.
From 1970 to 2020.
And I didn't live through the peak of Yoko hot takes, which would have been 68 to 75.
Well, I wasn't into the Yoko hot takes there, but I sure got the 1979 and 87 Yoko
version.
And watching it and realizing like none of the things that people said about Yoko were true, as far as you can tell. And also there's a lot more to say about Yoko than anyone ever thought to say. And where's my Yoko podcast? I got so much to say.
I think Get Back is a bad way to judge Yoko because she's really been sidelined by the editing. And I'm not sure why. Well, is that at her request? Is that at Sean's request?
But even sidelined by the editing, her presence there is not nearly as disruptive as everyone's hot take thought.
And I think a lot of that's the editing. I think if you were to actually see...
Oh, you think she was dancing on top of Paul McCartney's head?
I think she is opining more. I think the record has her opining more than we see in the movie. I think she's kind of been softened by the movie.
You think that Peter Jackson is a Yoko revisionist and he's taking her out in order to not have her like screaming over Chuck Berry on the Mike Douglas show?
Well, Jackson's always insisting that the Beatles and their estates had no oversight, but it does seem weird that like there are times where we know she had a obnoxious thing to say and then it's missing from the movie.
And you,
because I thought the same thing as you.
Yeah.
And then it was the knowledgeable weirdos, Beatles weirdos, who were like, Yoko's really been downplayed here and it's not clear why.
Yeah. Right. Well, but he does that interview segment with every one of the Beatles themselves has something to say about Yoko. Mm-hmm. And none of them say anything bad. And you would expect to be able to see through clenched smiles. And Paul's like, yeah, look, Yoko's fine. Like he's not like glaring at the camera like, everything's fine here. I don't know. I'm ready to reevaluate my reevaluation of my original evaluation of Yoko takes. What you're saying is that Jackson was trying to make a good film that didn't anger people.
That didn't throw a lot of gasoline on the anti-Yoko fire.
And so he just took it out, but then it seemed but then that's expressing a viewpoint too.
I guess. Oh, yeah. You know?
Wow, okay.
Like not to let Yoko be irritating is in a way its own Yoko stance.
Is to silence Yoko.
I don't know. This is again It's good. That wasn't even John. Like, that no, was actually...
That was, she's here now.
You played a clip of one of your favorite Yoko performances. Mm-hmm. Installations, probably. Not even a performance.
You notice that she doesn't do any of that on any Beatles record, except for Revolution Number 9. But, you know, given the way she could moonwalk into things, it's kind of amazing that there's no Beatles track where she's vocalizing.
I just read this like 800-page book about the first 5 years of McCartney's solo career. And what you realize is that there are many, many instances of Linda being on the record being as deeply annoying as any Beatles spouse, including Yoko Ono.
You've heard those tapes, right?
Yeah.
The board tapes.
Yeah, I feel like that's mean.
Yeah,
she didn't,
pretty
she didn't even want to be in a band.
It's pretty mean.
Her husband's just like, and in the book, Paul comes off terribly because he's annoyed that she can't learn to sing and play keyboards as quickly as he, Paul McCartney, did.
Yeah.
But I learned very quickly.
It wasn't hard for me to play it backwards and over the top.
The one of the most commented upon moments in Get Back would be John Lennon receiving from a kind of a mysterious supporting character a guitar with a rotating neck. Do you remember this? Magic Alex provides him with this kind of Frankenstein bass guitar, electric guitar hybrid, where the neck actually spins.
This was one of the most commented upon moments in Get Back?
It's bizarre.
I mean, I must have been in the minority of people that's like, zoom in on those shoes. I got to see what shoe. What are those shoes? Show me those shoelaces. Anytime Magic Alex was on the screen, I was rolling my eyes to death.
Well, it's impossible to tune. And I think it's even commented on in the scene that, like, he's been given this great new invention that he can't tune. But all the Beatles are acting like this guy is their genius guru.
Yeah.
But then later on, they try to record in the new studio he's built for them.
Yeah.
You know famous folks, including musicians who then became
F-O-L-X folks.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. And folk musicians.
Yes.
You know, musician folks and you know, folk musicians.
I do.
And some of them were musicians who actually then became like really famous, like actually famous.
Yes.
Have you ever known anyone famous enough to get hangers on in their lives? You know, the premise of the TV show Entourage is that famous people accumulate like less talented but very persistent people around them, like barnacles.
Yes, I have and do know people.
You don't have to name names.
That have barnacles. And sometimes, you know, one of the things about indie rock was that it was supposed to be an antidote culturally to the excesses of the boa-wearing big rock stars of the early 90s.
With their big egos and big personalities.
Yeah. And you watched in rock and roll the big schism between like indie rock, which was humble and cool and inclusive, and the sort of Limp Bizkit era of musicians that took that rock excess and continued on with it.
And Steven Tyler was, if anything, too muted.
Too muted.
They said.
That's right. There needed to be more date rape in rock. And the late 90s and 2000, like white rock rappers, rap rockers, really filled in the gaps.
And certainly the vibe of acquaintance rape. Whether or not that's happening behind the scenes, you should feel as if that's a big part of the band.
But what happens in that kind of inclusive, like welcoming, humility-based rock stardom is that barnacles can attach themselves and end up being really hard to shake.
Because there's an emotional...
Yeah, and they feel...
It's a family.
They feel bought in, and the artist hands over some kind of, you know, like, oh, I guess they're our manager now.
And wouldn't it be mean to not not let them run the website? Oh, and now manage the band.
They said they wanted to, and I said it was cool, I guess. But now we have four managers, and I can't tell them. But yeah, there have been problem people in.
What do those people want? Do they just like the proximity to the glamour and the art, or is it a living now, and so they don't have a choice?
I mean, music. Is a language that speaks directly to our emotional lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it speaks to our emotional lives with incredible economy and precision. And part of it is that that music means different things to different people, and it's extremely personal in every case. So you over-identify with musicians. You feel like they're writing to you. And you don't even need to have a mental illness to feel like, how could you possibly know that something so specific about me? In a little bit, it's like a magic trick, right? Because then you talk to the songwriter and they say, well, no, that actually is a song about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. It's not anything to do with you. And you're like, no, but my grandmother's name was Fitzgerald. And then, yeah, musicians are also sexy, and that world seems sexy, and the lack of being nailed down to any particular time or place, it feels liberating, and so people do want.
I just need to be in this world of magnetic people. How can I go back to my?
It's more that they feel like I belong in this world of magnetic people. Interesting. And why aren't I recognized, even though I've never made anything or put anything out, even though I'm not a magnetic person
in any way?
I feel like I am, and I belong in this place, and I've met this artist, and they seem to like me, and now I'm going with them to a second location, and now they're not going to shake me, right? Because I've got my toehold, and there is that feeling like, I belong here. You see this with almost all barnacles. I belong here. I belong here more than people maybe that even do belong here.
In some cases, there's an I knew them when factor, right? And maybe the artist likes that. Yeah, this is the idea I have from nowhere of like hip-hop entourages, that it's like, this is what keeps me real. Like, yeah. These are my people from the neighborhood.
You notice with me all the time where every time you come into the bunker, I say, have you got me a job with Jeopardy yet? Where is my, I know that announcer is going to die one of these days. I'm right here, Ken. And you're always like, yeah. I'm really just an employee there.
You're my friend from around the way that keeps me honest.
If I were there every time, like, welcome to Jeopardy. It's me, Ken's problematic friend.
I think you should say that, actually. Do you remember old game shows where the announcer would be like, and me, Don Pardo,
whatever? I would bring that back. And here, your host, Ken Jennings, and me, John Roderick.
I'm
not kidding, by the way.
I understand. The first two times I thought you were kidding.
Yeah.
Times 3 through 300, I was like, that's, yeah, right. He's not.
Because, Ken, I belong there.
I'm a magnetic.
I belong there.
I'm a magnetic announcer type. I could wear a shiny velour jacket.
I have them already. I have a closet full.
The thing that came out in our Yoko conversation was that there's
the
a
one we
lot
just
of,
had or the ones we've been having?
Those we just said, but also the ones we will have in the future. Time is a three-dimensional solid that I can see from outside it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Is that there's a lot of kind of Beatles Kremlinology about who the bad guys were or even are.
Yeah.
Yoko was bad. Yoko was good.
John was bad.
Paul's bad. Yeah. Paul's good.
Even Ringo got pretty frustrating there. Frustrated there.
I mean, one thing I learned watching that Scorsese thing about George is don't idealize George.
No.
He's a messed up guy on some level.
I mean, George was always my favorite Beatle, but yeah, George is a brat.
Like, are the Eastmans terrible? Everyone kind of agrees that Alan Klein was terrible.
I think that's on the books.
And luckily, all the Beatles eventually came around to, oops, he was actually going to rook us, just like he did the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. Alan Klein was brought in by John Fogerty when the band said, hey, we want a new manager. You're a bad manager. Fogerty's answer was, let's have a meeting with Alan Klein. And they had a meeting with him, and they all hated him.
Is this a bonus episode of your spinoff podcast, Saul Zantz?
Bringing it back to Saul Zantz.
Everything comes back to Saul Zantz. But they didn't, right? They decided, dodged the Klein bullet.
They all knew right away, because they were good old San Francisco boys. They knew, no, this guy's bad. They weren't like these British dudes that can get fooled.
Well, this is what we talked about in the Saul Zantz entry, which is these people are just heartbreakingly young. It doesn't matter if it's Jerry Lee Lewis or Sam Cooke or John Lennon. They are 24 years old and never had a real adolescence. And they're...
Except Lennon was like 29 by the time he brought Alan Klein in.
Lennon met Magic Alex in 1965.
And Lennon was born in 40, right?
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
But these guys, I mean, they have the... they have the prolonged childhood adolescence that everyone does today, but which would have been unusual, which I'm sure their parents looked down on because, you know, John's parent, you know, Paul's parents probably think he should be a milkman by the time he's 22, like his brother. Uh-huh. And instead he's still dinking around in Hamburg with his school buddies. Like, get a job.
I like that you said Hamburg.
Yeah. Like the hat.
Like the hat. Not Hamburg, well, like we say in English.
Well, I don't think a German would say
Hamburg.
I don't think a German would say Hamburg.
No, but he said Hamburg.
Hamburg. Hamburg.
He wouldn't say Hamburg.
No, he would say Hamburg.
Hamburg.
We live in the Northwest where there is no distinction between these vowels. There's just ah, or there's ah.
But do you say, give me a hamburger?
No, I do not.
I love hamburgers.
But I might start, actually. I'm kind of taking to it now. I think Magic Alex is another, I just mentioned that because he's another kind of Beatles world character who has no supporters today, except as a dazzling and eccentric figure. No one is going to say he was good for the lads or had something to say or do.
Wait, are you going to say, is this a Magic Alex revisionism show?
That he was actually good and did invent all these lasers?
Yeah. Magic Alex, like, is the genius behind Dark Side of the Moon.
I do not have a hot Magic Alex take. Oh, okay. No. But I think many people, including even like people who could name every Beatles record and every Beatles single, maybe don't have a good sense of the depth of Magic Alex and his weirdness.
I think there are a lot of people that can name every Beatles album.
That's what I'm saying. Like, the world is full of someone who would be like, oh, I like the Beatles. I know the Beatles. I'm a Beatles fan.
Yeah.
Who don't understand the Magic Alex story.
Right. Okay. Good. Yes. Agreed.
In 1965, John Lennon is in the Indica Gallery in London. As you can gather from its name, this is kind of a countercultural gathering spot.
For those following along who are not familiar, Indica is a kind of marijuana.
What?
Marijuana.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Did you know?
No, I didn't.
Yeah.
But which kind is it? I always get them confused. Which kind's the
sativa
cool kind?
And indica.
Is sativa more of the, which one's like the chill, laid back one, and which one's a little more in your face?
Sativas are the ones that are all heady and like, whoa,
deep thoughts,
dude. And then indica is more, you know, like, I'm relaxed and I'm like feeling chill and not, you know, I'm not. I mean, the problem with.
Interestingly, they named the gallery after the sit on a beanbag one and not the.
Yeah, well, yes, right? Because the sativas are like, they jazz you, but that's where all the paranoia and like.
Yeah, I'm not going to go to the sativa gallery. Although that kind of 60s art, you know, this fluxus art that these people converge on actually makes me anxious, not relaxed.
Exactly. So the indica is like, come on in and just chill out. And
it had been founded by three London artists, at least two of whom, the first two of whom had deep connections to the music scene. John Dunbar had been married to Marianne Faithfull, mm-hmm. and one of the other co-owners was no less than Peter Asher, half of the folk rock duo Peter and Gordon.
I have met him.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. And the brother of Jane Asher.
Yes.
About whom Paul wrote, I've Just Seen a Face, and whom he almost married. History would be pretty different, maybe, if
she's Paul very
actually
beautiful.
Married Jane Asher.
If you read Jane Asher on Paul McCartney, she's like, why do people keep asking me about Paul McCartney? I've got a lot else going on in my life. That was a long time ago.
I like the idea that maybe Paul is actually not that interesting.
Well, yeah.
That he's a once-in-a-generation talent, but also maybe, you know, not a great hang.
Her whole vibe is like, oh God, again?
Again with the
Paul McCartney? Like, I've lived a long life. Pretty funny. I mean, pretty good, pretty right, but also like, it is Paul McCartney.
So Lennon and the other Beatles, you know, if you can't interview Paul McCartney for 4 minutes today without him telling you that he was into avant-garde art and poetry way before John was.
It comes out in the first 30
it's
seconds.
One of his favorite things to say.
You know, I've tried LSD.
And
my Paul is so bad. I'm sorry to keep doing it.
All the Beatles turn into Ringo when you do them. There's like a 7-second clip of Gary Oldman doing all the Beatles like in order.
Oh,
and he could just switch. Like the clip is like sharp and abrupt, but maybe that's what you want to look at.
Oh, I want to see that.
At Lennon meets another guy who's been hanging around this gallery, who's recently come from his native Greece with a student visa, one Yannis Alexis Mardis. He tells, he's actually already connected to the music scene. He has somehow gotten in with Brian Jones a few years earlier. I think we can maybe credit drugs with a lot of these friendships.
Yes.
And because he's a bit of a tinkerer, he explains that he was a bit of a young electronics prodigy.
Hello.
Back home in Greece.
Famous.
Has an engineering background.
Yeah, Greece, famous for technology.
Around 500 BC,
yeah.
Like nobody could beat him.
But you think about all the Greek receivers and transmitters and amplifiers.
Yeah, since then, maybe a bit of a dry spell for mm-hmm. them technology-wise. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe they still lead the world in panpipe, mm-hmm. pan flute production.
Mm-hmm. No, that's all coming out of Ecuador.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It's true. You don't see a bunch of Greek guys on the street playing El Condor Pasa.
No, I'm afraid not.
But he's apparently a real charismatic, magnetic, charming character, you know, or maybe just the musicians don't want to say, yeah, we're charismatic and we let one of these boring barnacles in. I think he must have something based on the degree to which he impresses Brian Jones, John Lennon.
I mean, what he has is the fact that none of those guys understand the technology behind what they're doing.
I think that's
Paul
true.
Did. I think Paul was curious and paying attention and watching what was happening at the mixing board.
But to everybody else, it's just magic?
A little. You know, like Lennon famously tried to sing upside down to change the quality of his voice. Like every time George Martin said, well, what if we put a microphone behind a pan? Lennon was like, that's it. That's my John Lennon impression. That's it.
That's fantastic. Don't shoot.
Oh. Too soon.
Mardis explains that his father was variously described as a Greek army officer or maybe even in the secret police. So he has kind of a glamorous kind of old world Mediterranean family history that can be dipped into. He seems to be somebody with mystique.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at pictures of him, he's one of these guys who maybe looks a little bit different in every photo. He's, sometimes he has these kind of gaunt Bowie-like good looks. Other times he's a little more Hemsworthy, and sometimes he's just straight up, guy.
Looks like Peter Jackson.
Yeah, exactly. Guy with kind of thick liver lips who you would totally believe is in Procol Harum or something, like these,
wow.
A lot of these British invasion guys were not the best looking boys in their school.
That's true.
Even the ones that could shag all the birds, as we would have said at the time. And he gets to talking with John Lennon. John Lennon immediately thinks this guy is a genius. He's not just a barnacle. He's a fast talker.
Lennon, famous judge of character.
Lennon never wrong mm-hmm. about, first meeting, final meeting for that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Klein. Yeah. Maybe he's a crook, but he's our crook.
I mean, this was an era where there really was in the culture, not to throw the boomers under the bus one more time, but you see it with any revolutionary era where suddenly the fact that one thing seems changeable means that all rules are off the table, and maybe it's possible that you can bend sound waves with a piece of straw.
If you're John Lennon, maybe you went to art school for 18 months and that's all you got.
But like, here it is. This guy says that he can make a musical instrument out of four soup cans. Yeah, finally, we're throwing big guitar out the window.
And a lot of these artists seemed like they were going to embrace this idea that scientific and technological achievements would further the aims of the counterculture.
Mm.
But people loved the academic cred of a Timothy Leary or somebody like that.
And I guess they were rebelling against a studio culture at EMI that was very lab coat, like keep the engineers over here away from the musicians. There's tea time every day at 10. So there was something to rebel against for sure.
Yeah. That was very much unlike what the rest of their lives felt like. You look at descriptions of a Beatles recording session in 1964 and they get in and record the whole record in 2 days.
Yeah.
And then, half of the second day is overdubs. And then they're like, well, lads, we just made Beatles for sale. Let's have a drink to celebrate. Whereas, from the Get Back sessions, you understand what they really want in the late 60s when their drugs of choice have changed is what the rest of their life has become. A lot of sprawling around with friends and good vibes. And you know what would be amazing is what if we did this differently?
And what's crazy is that they still made 2 records a year. Whereas
they switched from Speed to Acid and then Weed and Acid and still made 2 records a year.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the calendar for the Get Back sessions, it's like, yeah, well, we've got 2 whole weeks to make the album.
It feels so lazy, but then Ringo's got to make The Magic Christian.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the first movie ever where Ringo Starr making The Magic Christian is the ticking clock.
I mean, I've been working on the 4th Long Winters record since 2009, and I still haven't got all the tracks.
Don't you have to get done in 2 weeks to make The Magic Christian? Yeah. You haven't decided whether you're going to do the big live concert in Tunisia or on the Queen Mary?
Listen.
Or on the moon?
Michael Lindsay-Hogg really wants it to be in Tunisia. I don't understand.
I guess the thing that when Alex eventually meets with Lennon outside of the gallery, the thing that wows him is kind of related to the light shows he's been doing for the Rolling Stones. He's created the Nothing Box,
okay,
which has much in common with many of his later inventions.
Mm-hmm. It's a finger box.
It's a Nothing Box. It basically lights up in amusing ways. You know, an hour in Radio Shack and you can make one of these, but he tells Lennon that it basically duplicates an acid trip, but with science.
Okay.
You know? And I guess now that I think about it, even the appeal of drugs back then was that, you know, these are just natural plants. You know, science will someday understand that this is expanding our minds.
We're just innocent men.
we're just normal men. And Lennon loves this light up box and brings him over to Paul's house and says, "This is my new guru, Magic Alex." See, that's a really good Lennon right there.
That's pretty good. Pretty good, not very good Lennon.
Just amazing. Amazing John Lennon.
I love that this all starts with a Schrodinger's box, like a function machine.
There's an empty button box.
And a light. And Lennon's like, this is it.
He could have opened the box and seen there was nothing in it, but he didn't. And so history goes very differently. And as a result, from 1965 all the way through the end, the inner circle of Beatles people, which was pretty small, you know?
Glyn Johns.
Once Brian Epstein dies, it's basically just his assistant Peter Brown and then Mal, you know, they're two roadies, Mal and Neil, who kind of managed them and got them their paper and their tea. And suddenly now, John's new guru, a mysterious Greek man. John Lennon was very much under his spell. There's no such thing as a genius, he would say, but if there are any, he is one. And it was because Alex would make a series of extremely lofty promises of things he had invented, was working on. And I think in reality, what he would do is he would read about, you know, one thing he would just do is say, hey, this would impress a musician. I'll tell them I'm going to invent this. But he would also just take credit for something that was in the papers. You know, if somebody said someday telephones would be handheld, he would go to the Fab Four and say, I'm working on a telephone you can hold in your hand. And they'd say, wow.
Weirdly, by then, almost all telephones
could be held in the hand.
Hold in the hand.
No, the Beatles were still cranking one on the wall.
Have you ever, this is going to be interesting because it's not the type of thing you would normally answer. Have you ever fallen under the spell of someone?
Hmm.
I mean, other than your beautiful wife.
Maybe I wouldn't know.
You might still be under the spell of someone? Like, of for you. Instance, a co-host of your podcast? A
charismatic Seattle musician. That's a really interesting question.
Have you ever been bamboozled or like thought you knew somebody and then discovered that, oh, wait a minute, that person was not who I thought?
Yeah, a few times. I remember as a, you know, especially kind of into adolescence, finding out that maybe a couple of my friends' charming dads actually had kind of been living double lives. And one guy in particular that my dad had really trusted and had kind of got a new, had found a job for at his new gig. I think he was working for maybe Oracle at the time. He got this guy a job and then found out the guy was just a train wreck and had caused his wife and kids no end of pain. And this is very shocking because when you're that age, you think these respectable adults who always give me a smile and a wink, they know what's up and they're not doing stupid things and they certainly don't have mistresses.
Yeah. People are who they say they are.
And then it turns out, no, half of them are not, or, you know, maybe they believe who they say they are, but they, you know, objectively have made some terrible choices.
Yeah.
And hurt people. I'm trying to think if it ever happened to me as an adult where I was really disillusioned. Maybe it's still coming. Who were you ever most disillusioned by?
Well, you know, I, in my life, I've known a lot of sleazes, and psychos and, you know, people, not even in just in show business, but just right. regular amount of,
are you saying there's sleazy people in outside of show business?
Yeah. Just, you know, if you do any amount of hitchhiking, you're going to meet people that when they first pick you up, seem really nice. And
creepier as the day goes on.
Yeah, an hour into the drive, they start to be really weird. But there was a guy here in Seattle in the last half a dozen years who became really ingratiated with a lot of musicians. He was very good on social media. He had a band. He hired some local players that were all like super good. He suddenly was everywhere. And he knew everybody. He had a story about how he knew everybody. And on social media, it appeared that he did. And he got booked on tours with really big bands. And at one point, he said he was putting together a benefit album for the West Memphis Three, if you remember them.
Yeah.
And put together this benefit album, and the benefit album had Springsteen and Tom Petty and all these, you know,
because it's a noble cause, he's racially railroaded.
Yeah, kid. All these big, big artists. And he used that as a fundraising tool. And he got very close to some people that I know who are, you know, like big artists.
Names, yeah.
Very close. And he never got close to me, but he was definitely, I knew him well and a peripheral figure and really funny. I was at a party and I was there with a local musician that comes up on the show fairly regularly, a big Seattle musician. Mm-hmm. And this guy, the guy in question, rolls up. Hey man, what's going on? Oh, and I was like, hey, how are you? Lots of, you know, shucking and jiving. And my buddy says, leans over and goes, let's get out of here. Let's go, you know, let's go back to, we'll go back to my place, he said in his Seattle accent.
It's Mick Jagger.
And this guy, the fellow is like, hey, where are you guys going? You know, like, can I tag along? And my friend goes, let's get away from this guy, like pronto. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, see you later. You know, finger guns. And we got outside and unnamed rock star was like, that guy's a sleaze. I've never seen him before in my life, but I can just tell he's a sleaze. And I was like, a sleaze? Tough talk. And he was like, no. I smelled sleaze. And he's a pretty good judge of character. So I was like, sleaze, interesting. And I started to take a closer look at him. And I was like, he does seem a little, like, is this all true? Well, within weeks, the whole West Memphis 3 thing was revealed as a giant scam. Tom Petty, Bruce Springsteen, none of them were involved. He'd gone around to all of these different artists claiming.
Yeah, he's trying to get the circle going.
Yeah, that the other one was in and the other one was in. And the whole thing collapses. And he'd been doing, his band was on tour with what the hell was it? Well, big band. And he had just gotten his band on there by his friendship leveraging.
Yeah.
The whole thing came unglued. The feds got involved. They convicted him for like mail fraud and sent him to prison. He had made $250,000 selling the something somethings to the something else's and it was like a bomb went off in the whole local culture because all these people were getting paid by him. You know, like some big musicians were in his band, including the bass player of the Long Winters. And so
it's a trust-based business, indie rock.
Yeah, and it's all about, and especially with the advent of social media, if you're online and you're joking around with your buddy, and this guy comes into the thread and he presents himself just beautifully as a friend of each of you, your instinct is to go, oh, well, I guess my buddy knows this guy. And he just, I don't know what it is, a certain way of talking. Because a lot of people try to do that. Hey, I noticed you guys are talking. Hello. And it shuts it right down. But this was just a like, oh, I guess he's a friend of.
I think it's easier online.
Yeah.
Because everybody feels a little in their own basement online. So you're like, oh, these two must know each other. Of course, everyone here seems to know each other.
Especially in 2012.
Yeah.
And then when you look at his bona fides, it's like, oh, he does know that person. Oh, he knows them. So I guess he belongs. And anyway, so it was a big eye-opener for a lot of people. Some people felt really burned. And it also really upped my esteem for my pal who
immediately saw
just
it.
Just smelled it.
I have to think
that's a long aside, but
no, I have to think that would have, there's really no account of anybody at the time being like, well, this is bull. I mean, even, you know, in hindsight, every one of the Beatles says things like, oh, you can't believe what we believed from this guy. George says we were naive to the teeth. You know, Ringo just kind of rolls his eyes. Cause one of the things that Ringo remembers is that, in addition to his many inventions, Magic Alex knew he could open everybody's third eye. Literally by like trepanning a hole in their head. He was telling the Beatles, you know, if you drill, the way to get cosmic is literally to drill a third eye into your head.
And that was where Ringo drew the line?
Yeah, luckily none of them did. I mean, he was already getting chased by that Indian cult that wanted his rings.
Yeah, yeah, right.
You know, he'd had a rough couple of years. But here's the
best of all Beatles films.
John, I know you're picky about pillows because I have checked into a hotel with you.
Yeah.
And you will actually ask the desk clerk for specific pillow-related questions.
That's right. I have a lot I ask the desk clerks for special needs. And pillows and bedding are of a particular interest to me.
I am about to change your life. Mm-hmm. I'm about to ask you the five-word question that will change your life.
I'm ready.
Have you tried Hullo Pillow?
I do have a Hullo Pillow.
Hullo. I think because it has hulls of grain in it. Mindy, explain the joke to me. Hullo.
It does. It has buckwheat in it. The hulls of buckwheat?
I guess. I don't actually know what a hull is, but I'm gonna assume that these people know what their pun is doing.
Well, It's a pillow that I adore. It's heavy.
It's very firm and supportive.
I like a firm pillow.
I guess traditionally the Japanese put buckwheat in their pillow because it's actually better for your neck than the squishy, fluffy
kind of
pillow.
And it breathes a lot better. It doesn't get that kind of. This pillow is too hot on this side, and it feels all damp and weird.
It stays cool, which is my number one pillow gripe when pillows get hot.
It stays cool. It keeps your neck from feeling all wonky.
If you ever are using two pillows or like folding over a pillow, that's a sign that you don't have enough pillow and you might want to try something firmer. Like our friends at Hullo.
Well, you can also actually adjust the amount of hole inside of buckwheat. You can pour it out or add in order to create just the kind of pillow you're looking for.
You can choose your own buckwheat adventure with the Hullo pillow. They sent us one and I have never got to use it because my wife appropriated it.
Yes.
She loves it. It's perfect for her and she is a Hullo convert.
Well, what's crazy, and you wouldn't know this because you don't talk to desk clerks about your pillow, but in fancy hotels, they actually sometimes have pillow menus where you can choose the cool kind of pillow you want. I know this because I'm always talking to people about pillows, and
send up the pillow sommelier. You'll say the pillow concierge.
You'll actually see Hullo pillows sometimes on at nice hotels.
If you are at a pillow inflection point in your life where you feel like maybe you have made the wrong pillow choices and are interested in exploring a bigger pillow universe, here's the deal from Hullo. They will send you a pillow that you can sleep on for 60 nights.
That's 2 months.
Or days if you work nights.
Sure.
And if Hullo isn't for you, just ship it back and they'll give you a refund.
Now, let me just jump in and say, they don't then send that pillow out to someone else. They fire it out of a cannon.
They release that buckwheat back into... They actually make buckwheat pancakes out of it and eat the pancakes.
And that, and they serve them at Waffle House, which is a co-owner. No, none of that's true. But you do get to try out a Hollow Pillow for 60 nights.
How can I do this? How can I take advantage of this amazing deal, Jim?
Go to hollowpillow.com, which is hullopillow.com/omnibus. And if you try out more than one pillow, you get $20 off per pillow.
Ooh.
And 1% of all profits of Hollow Pillow are donated to the Nature Conservancy, because nature is where they come from.
That's where buckwheat comes from. That's 100% right. Of all buckwheat comes from nature. Mm-hmm. You'll get fast, free shipping on every order.
So go to Hollow Pillow, that's H-U-L-L-O, pillow.com/omnibus.
You can even give the gift of better sleep. Mm. Hollow is the unique gift your friends and family will appreciate, and they'll think about you every night as they go to bed, if that's the kind of special romantic gift you're looking to give. Here's the list of things that Alexis Mardis promised that he could make his new musician friends. And you'll see that many of them are kind of music-oriented, which shows that he knows who his audience is. Like, he tells them, you know how you hate it when you guys are always, people can record your songs off the radio. What if that was encoded so you couldn't? And all the Beatles are like, yes, see, this guy gets it. Mm-hmm. This guy gets it. Then they couldn't tape our songs off the radio. He said he was going to make a way to modify just a little handheld transistor radio so that you could actually use it for a portable recording studio. See, some of these, they start out things where you're like, yeah, I bet actually somebody with the right transistors could do this.
Well, and digital rights stuff eventually figured out a way to encode it, and you do have a studio the size of a transistor radio now.
What if you didn't have to hang speakers because the wallpaper was the loudspeaker? What if, John?
That hasn't yet come to pass.
He was very into walls. What if you could actually paint a wall with paint that would, the electric current would go through it such that you could change the color of the wall? George said, well, you could paint me car. And he said, absolutely, I could paint your car. You know, so when you changed gears, the car would change color.
Baby, when you paint my car.
Burr, 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 burr.
I mean, that doesn't sound far off from, remember when Bill Gates built that house over on the lake and all the artwork would change depending on who walked in?
Yeah.
You had a little fob that was like, well, I like Renoir.
A lot of these do seem like, this is the future house from a Ray Bradbury story kind of a vibe, you know? I don't know why they believed this one, but once he found out George was into cars, he casually mentioned that, you know, just using parts from the engines of John's and George's car, he was going to build a flying saucer.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think drugs explain quite a bit of this.
Mm-hmm. Flying saucer with a carburetor.
Drugs and youth explain why, you know, the four richest men on earth would be like, yeah, of course. Yeah, let's make our cars into flying saucers. An X-ray camera. You know, he was interested in telephones. You know, what if they could be personalized so that it would just be activated by your voice? Some of them are musical, like, you know, we'll put a force field around the drum kit, of course. So then, you know, you could be in the same room with the drum, you could still isolate the drum sound, even if you're all in the same room, because we'll use force fields to baffle the sound. But then, what if your guitar was solar powered? Think about that.
But we're always indoors when we play.
Tricky. I mean, maybe it's good if you're making the Fool on the Hill video and you're...
Right, for that, in that instance, yeah.
You're on a hillside in Cornwall or something.
When Paul used to sit on his porch and play Blackbird for the fans at the gate.
For Paul in Scotland, it's perfect.
Yeah.
But nobody else needs... Many rock and roll performances, you probably know this, are at night.
Yeah. Even the outdoors ones, even the weirdly, outdoors ones are often at night.
Maybe especially the outdoors ones are at night. He said he could build them a house that would hover in the air.
Hmm. No, he couldn't.
No, he explained it. He would have an invisible beam.
Right.
Maybe at first they're like, no, you can't.
But then...
He's pulling our legs, isn't he? And then he would say, no, there's an invisible beam. And
oh,
they would say,
oh, of course, right. The invisible beam. I never thought of that.
An X-ray camera, an artificial sun. Now, you know how, maybe this goes with a solar-powered guitar.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know how it's dark and you want your solar-powered guitar to work. What you need is a sun that rises and shines in the nighttime.
What's the artificial sun made of?
Lasers.
Lasers.
He explained that he would use lasers. And of course, that was at the time an eye-catching new technology.
Right. And makes perfect sense. You use lasers.
No, I don't want to. I don't want to claim the historicity necessarily of all of these things because.
I love historicity.
Martis virtuosity. No, what was it?
Virtuosic.
Historicity.
Historicity. Historicity.
Martis has in fact successfully shouted down newspapers who have published lists of these outrageous claims that he made in the 60s. In 2008, I think around 2008, the Independent was forced to print a retraction. No, Magic Alex never told the Beatles that he could build a house that would float or a sun made of lasers. But it may just be that he knows it's hard to prove that he didn't say it, you know, so, you know, and many of the principals are gone or don't remember or were pretty high at the time or were tripping balls. So, and he claimed that, and, you know, often, as you can imagine, as the years go by, he does not produce these inventions. You know, we all know there's no tape of George Harrison flying in a flying saucer.
As far as we know.
Hard to prove it doesn't exist, but...
With a Rolls Royce engine. If there was a company that was going to make a flying saucer engine, it might be Rolls Royce.
So he would often claim that a fire had, or that this turned out to be harder. This one's taking longer than I thought, but here's the new idea.
Yeah. This is always the thing, right? This is the QAnon issue. None of the things that Q ever predicted came true. Not a one.
But you just move on to the next.
You just move on to the next.
Because that's what's exciting. He also became very enmeshed in the private life of the Beatles in interesting ways. It wasn't just that every few months he'd show up and show them the blueprints for some new gimmick. Like, they were hanging out as much as they were with any of their barnacles. And that's harsh. I don't want to say Neil or Mal or, you know, a lot of these people worked for them.
Yeah, you get the feeling that Neil and Mal maybe weren't that fun to hang out with. They were fun. It was fun to have them there.
They were from the old days.
Yeah, but they weren't like a good hang.
They were from the north, and now that they're surrounded by wealthy Londoners, that's what they want, right?
Of all of the people that the Beatles would have had access to, which is to say, everyone in the world, in 1968, who do you think would have been actually fun to hang out with? Because I don't think Keith Richards would have been any fun, although he seems like he's rad. I think he would have been really boring.
Malcolm X.
He would have been not alive anymore.
That's true. 68, you said. Who is fun to hang out with?
I agree he would have been fun.
Peter O'Toole.
Oh, like those guys. Those guys.
Just hanging out with Oliver Reed and Richard Burton.
Come on. Why weren't they hanging out with those guys? Well, they were all a little older, right? They would have been older and...
Maybe that's it. They're intimidated.
Yeah. Right. Sean Connery. But no. No, they weren't hanging with those guys. Magic Alex is who they choose.
They choose this mysterious Greek guy. So, like, so their private lives get so enmeshed that funny stories result. Like, they get the idea that maybe they should be spending some time in Greece. Maybe the Beatles should get a place in Greece. And I think what they're thinking is Alex says, yeah, I'll set it up so you guys can just import and use whatever drug you want.
Uh-huh.
Let's go to Greece. And I think they've had fun on a vacation. So they go to Athens for a while and they're trying to figure out, Magic Alex is like, what you should do is you should buy an island in the Aegean.
Agreed.
And then, yeah, I mean, hard to disagree with that.
Yep.
And then you can just smoke grass there.
Yeah.
That's the end of the plan. Beginning and end of the plan.
Yeah. Call it make it a new country.
It's a new country where acid is legal.
Beetlevania.
And as they spend a little bit of time in touring around Athens, they find that, you know, they'll go to some village and they'll crest the hill and there will be 100 photographers there.
Hmm.
And it becomes clear that Alex has sold them out and he protests that, no, this is what I had to do. You know, this is how we get you, from getting arrested at customs. Is you know, you play the PR game and now Greece is a drug wonderland for you. They rent a yacht and they find in one version of the story they want the house to be connected by tunnels. They want to have, you know, each Beatle has his own house where you can then go through a tunnel to the place where they record, or maybe the big house they all live together and help. It's not clear.
Yeah. They each have their own door.
Right.
It just opens into a big cavern.
In other, and it's a blue Santorini kind of a door. In other versions of the story, they find an island that has four smaller islands around, and they're like, this is it.
Oh, there it is.
We'll each have our own island, love.
Not realizing that that's always a volcano.
And in fact, they do devote some money to this sale. They're like, all right, Alex, make the purchase. Let's buy these islands where we're going to live now. And George Harrison remembers it fondly as one of the only times they ever made money in the 60s, because they converted the pounds to dollars before the deal fell through. And then when they got them back, the pound had sunk. And so they were delighted to find...
Oh, they'd made a currency exchange cash.
They had each made several shillings transaction, which George sardonically remembers as one of the only times they ever made money on one of these stupid business ideas.
That's a good anecdote.
Alex, briefly, you can see him in Magical Mystery Tour. He's hanging out with them enough to be in the movies. He actually goes with them to India in 68.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Of all the people, fun people in the world to hang out with in 68.
Donovan.
George chooses Donovan and the Maharishi. Mia Farrow seems like maybe pretty, but not a fun afternoon, right?
I can't think of her as fun.
And she has a sister who's so much less fun than her that they write a song about how she's not fun.
Yeah.
Mia's sister, Prudence Farrow, comes with them to Rishikesh, is that where it is? And
not fun, that whole gang.
And it's not fun. And in fact, Alex is the reason why it all falls apart.
Really?
I thought
it was that John saw through the Maharishi.
So the reason why John decides the Maharishi is a charlatan, Patty Boyd says in her book, is that Alex has come to him like worm tongue, whispering, hey, the Maharishi is he's been hitting on Cynthia all week. I can't believe you haven't noticed.
Oh. So, it's the one time that John cared who was hitting on Cynthia.
Well, John's been sleeping his way through Europe for a decade, but if someone were to look at Cynthia, that's different.
Sure. He's just a jealous guy.
That's right. He truly is. And maybe Run for Your Life is actually based on real emotions. He's awful misogyny he's experiencing.
I think that's true.
And so Alex convinces him that the Maharishi is trying to sleep with Prudence Farrow, and he's trying to sleep with Cynthia, and we got to get out of here. And I think that's one reason why John sours on the Maharishi and they leave early. And I think later, you find interviews with them just a few years later being like, yeah, it turns out that's not true at all. And I think maybe John felt bad for what he had done to George there. But, George and John had a real antipathy for many years. And I think a lot of it dates back to John believing what turned out to be
scandalous,
scurrilous rumors about George's guru. 2 weeks after returning from India in May 1968, Cynthia and some friends, I think including maybe Patty Boyd or maybe her sister Jennifer, about whom Donovan wrote Jennifer Juniper, and who at this point is dating Alex, some subset of this Beatles orbiting galaxy. Apparently, there's only 11 people in Britain to date
right
at this time if you're high.
Right. Twiggy was elsewhere.
Twiggy was busy. Twiggy was making the boyfriend in LA or wherever. And so they decided to go back to Greece. And Cynthia comes home from this Greek vacation to find John and a Japanese woman looking longingly at each other's eyes in her kitchen. She comes back to the Kenwood house, and Yoko has basically moved in, and
she said, breathe. And the rest was history.
Cynthia runs brokenhearted to the apartment of her friends, Magic Alex and Jennifer Juniper.
Right. Where else would you go?
Because, to explain that, we've been gone for a week and suddenly John seems to have fallen in love with this artist. And Alex is like, there, stay with us. And then that night he tries to get in bed with her.
With Cynthia.
Alex tries to get in bed with Cynthia Lennon.
Now, where is this coming from? Where does this story come from?
This is in Cynthia's book, actually.
Wow.
I think there were other rumors that, maybe he had tried to, that he had forced himself on her or whatever. And in Cynthia's book, she says, no, he just made like a really, really brazen pass. And I thought it was creepy and told him to hit the road.
Julian was asleep in a dog bed.
Julian's asleep in a
the other room.
But, you know, speaking of Julian, a few weeks after this, I think John protests. No, no, you know, he does not want to blow up his marriage. He says, I'm sorry, Cynthia.
Yeah, yeah.
She means nothing, just like all the other women. And you need to come back. But then it's just a short time later that Cynthia is on another trip to Italy with some friends. I think this is part of the problem. So John keeps trying to get her to the Mediterranean so mm-hmm. he can sleep with Eleanor Braun or whoever.
Oh, you're saying that John is sending Cynthia on on exotic trips?
Well, clearly there's a lot of distance in the, you know, because he's traveling too. You know, he'll be like, Paul and I are going to New York for a week. You should do something fun. And maybe what John has in mind is a certain series of assignations. While Cynthia is in Italy, no less than Magic Alex appears. And he's the one that John has chosen to give the message. I have some news from John. He's going to divorce you, take Julian away from you, and send you back to Hoylake, which is her little village on the peninsula across the Mersey from
right.
Although from Liverpool, whence she came.
He couldn't make her go back to Hoylake.
No, there's nothing in British law that says you can divorce your wife and send her to Hoylake. Maybe there is. Maybe it's some Henry VIII era clause in British common law. You can force your ex to move to Hoylake.
It's home rule.
And this is from Philip Norman's book, which I think is a pretty reliable source on Lenin in that period. So basically, Magic Alex just shows up and says, he's going to divorce you and he's going to get Julian and you need to go back to the North. You guys are done. And in fact, I think the other thing John has sent him to do in Italy at this time is to like hire a private detective to see if you can follow Cynthia around and see if there's anything suspicious going on that we can use in the forthcoming case, because I want this over and Yoko and I are soulmates.
Right. And Alex is both hiring the investigator and also trying to be the problem.
And then trying to sleep with the ex-wife and then delivering the news, you know, being the process server. So he's deeply enmeshed in, you know, you think to the degree to which maybe John has nobody he can trust with this kind of errand, that he's sending his crackpot blinking light inventor
right
to do this kind of dirty work. And maybe it doesn't say much for Alex that he's like, sure, I'll do these deeply cruel errands after I tried to sleep with your wife.
Joe Meek was, at that point, involved somewhere else.
Joe Meek, that's what it was. I was trying to remember. We have done another entry about a crackpot music studio guy. Except Joe Meek was actually
He was good genius at the studio stuff. Yeah. It was making friends with people he was bad at.
This guy's the inverse. This guy's Joe Meek from the antimatter universe.
Yeah, the two of them together would have been a really formidable duo.
I can't believe they never teamed up. So now we get to the studio part of this story, which is, I think, what people remember, because this is another memorable scene in Get Back. When the Beatles hung on their Apple shingle in, I don't know, 67 or whenever it was. Oh, speaking, by the way, before I do that, like, he even had a co-writing credit with Lennon on What's the New Mary Jane? Is that the name of the song that it was going to be on the White Album and then was going to be a Plastic Ono Band single? And the Beatles said, no, it's not. And then I think it finally came out on Anthology 3 or something.
And his co-write, it consisted of
his weird whatever he was doing with an oscilloscope in the background. So it's actually credited to Lennon Martis for many years. And then when it came out on Anthology 3, suddenly it's Lennon McCartney. I think at that point they were like,
yeah,
this would be a problem on several levels.
Yeah, right. And who's going to sue?
If the credit here is different.
You know, the problem in all of this is that George Martin, who was their dad and should have, in the absence of Brian Epstein, they should have just allowed George Martin to tell them what was kosher and what was not.
They had Jewish dad and they had Gentile George Martin dad.
That's right. They didn't, I don't think George Martin stepped into that role, and look at him.
Well, as you can see in the movie, George Martin's distrust of Magic Alex is a big part of why he steps back during the sessions of what became Let It Be.
Yeah.
When the Beatles hung out their Apple shingle, they decided that they would have an electronics wing, and who better to helm it than Magic Alex? They set him up with a workshop in a converted garage. They're giving him £40 a week plus a royalty from all the patents from all the inventions that are immediately going to be coming. Because I'm sure he's telling them, you know, if I just had some.
Oh, yeah, 40 pounds a week.
If I just had 40 pounds a week, you can't imagine what kinds of invisible suns I would be
exactly
conjuring.
Black hole suns.
Floating houses.
Made of lasers.
Floating everywhere. And so you'll see pictures from him in this time, and he's got more of a Carl Sagan-y vibe where he's
letting his hair go long.
He's a cool counterculture scientist with like a flowing hair, but also a black turtleneck and a white coat.
Uh-huh.
He may be wearing a white coat when he shows up in Get Back. I can't remember. because he is what he has promised them around this time is that he's going to set up a new studio for them in Apple Records. It's going to be digital, which means computers. Like,
yes,
you know what the future is, computers. My studio will have computers, and as a result, it'll have a 72-track mixing desk.
72 tracks. Nowadays, doesn't seem like a lot of tracks. Those days, that's a lot of
tracks. Well, you hear stories about how dazzled the Beatles are by 8-track recording, because now they don't have to, what do you call it, mix down the, you know, the bass and the drums or whatever onto the same track every time you need to add something, you know?
Let's call it that.
Is that right? Mix down?
Mix down. Let's call mix down. Submix.
Because that's what you would have to do. If all four of your tracks are full, then you're like, you know what we should have here is a guitar overdub. Then you're like, well, where do we put the guitar overdub?
And the proof is in the pudding. Music today is so much better.
It sounds so much better.
It sounds so much cooler and better than the Beatles.
In every way. But, you know, I think that was a legitimate limitation. You know, I'm reading about this McCartney book I'm reading. You know, he and Wings are often just on the spur of the moment being like, lads, let's go into the studio, which means EMI is booked. Which means they got to work someplace a little farther down on the technology ladder. And apparently, like, Abbey Road was the only studio that had this thing whereby you could isolate the drums in a different room. Basically, you could have artists in two different rooms, and you could easily sync up the sound.
Mm-hmm.
So in this book, Paul is basically trying to invent his own way to kludge that thing that only EMI has built in when he's recording somewhere else in West London or something. You know,
amazing to think that a room with a window in it had only, that was brand new technology. Like a room that has a window and then on the other side is another room.
I didn't understand a lot of the mixing, you know, the studio stuff that's going on in this book. But, you know, you can see Paul being the innovator where he's like, we got to stop. We got to run out and buy some crazy thing for me to bang on. You see that in Get Back.
Yeah.
But also, like, legitimately, they're running up against hard technology limits, and some guy who's like, oh, no problem, I'll just build you a new thing. That must have been very seductive.
They didn't have a Bill Putnam there.
Exactly. And Martin already does not trust the head of Apple Electronics, and you know, you see in the Get Back movie that he promises them this amazing studio, and in fact, when they go into Apple to try to record there, what they find is Magic Alex's studio is, you know, he's bought all these components from Germany that are still unassembled. He's delivered a 16-track mixing desk, which is poorly designed and, you know, looks like something from a World War II era naval vessel. It's got an oscilloscope.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really work. The mixing desk is not connected to the studio, which, okay. And correct me if I'm wrong here, John, I'm not a musician.
That seems like a limitation.
It seems like the main thing you want out of a mixing desk,
yeah,
is that it's connected to the studio in some way.
I mean, what is it connected to?
Yeah, what is it doing if it's not? He's put up 16 tinny speakers all over the wall telling them,
oh, I've seen this.
That this is very important. But George Harrison is shaking his head because it's stereo sound. Why do you need 16 speakers?
It's surround sound.
Yeah, but it's going to come out in stereo. Why are there 16 little tinny speakers on the wall?
I'm looking at a picture of them here in the Apple Music days, and this is something I've never seen before. It appears that John Lennon is wearing a shirt with a picture of himself on it from like the year before. So he's
a different look, a different haircut.
He's long-haired or medium long-haired Lennon, clean-shaven, and he's got a picture of Sergeant Pepper Lennon on his shirt. I don't think I've never seen this photo. And I've never seen Lennon in that shirt, and I really want a futureling to research that. Is that real? Did Lennon wear a shirt with his own picture on it?
I want someone to take that picture of him wearing the picture shirt and send it to maybe Julian or Yoko Ono.
And then
they wear a shirt of John wearing the shirt of himself.
Have you ever worn a shirt with your own picture on it?
No.
There is a shirt. So, a fan at one point made a shirt with a picture of me and Will Wheaton and another
the classic duo
guy. And we all were wearing shirts, obviously.
Good.
I've
never been naked with Will Wheaton. And I'm glad to hear that is true of both of us.
The artist wanted to know what we wanted on the shirts. And Will picked some, I don't know, Dungeons and Dragons thing. And I said, can you put on my shirt the artwork of us standing in the, and so it was one of these recursion shirts where I'm wearing on the shirt, I'm wearing a shirt with the picture of the shirt. And then on that, there's a tiny little picture of the shirt. I thought it was so smart, but of course I have one of only five extant copies of that shirt. So nobody ever gets to, I'm not in the business of wearing Will Wheaton on my shirt these days.
I think everything you read about the Beatles around their peak just kind of shows that they are kind of one marshmallow people. Like they're extremely impulsive.
Oh, I thought you were going to say one marshmallow short of a s'more.
Of a s'more, that expression that we love.
But they're just one marshmallow.
In the sense that they'll immediately just do or say the first thing they think of. You know, they'll say one thing in an interview, and the next day Lennon will tell Rolling Stone the opposite. He'll wear a shirt with his own picture on it.
And then never again.
He'll do a weird, you see them doing these weird kind of goon show voices for hours in Get Back, and you think these guys are convinced they've never had a bad idea. Like everything I do will be genius and funny, including wear a t-shirt of myself from last year. Mm. So the studio and the Beatles actually try it out and they find that the equipment, in addition to being eccentric, is just unusable. Like the recording just has this weird hiss and hum,
right,
that you can't get rid of. And you see this moment in the movie where George Martin, they run to Dad and say, how quick can you set us up with some borrowed equipment? And Martin wants nothing to do with this. And that's why Glyn Johns ends up kind of engineering, producing the whole thing, because
they move across town.
Cause Martin is like, this might be the Titanic. I'm going to stay away from this.
You know, Alan Parsons worked on that.
Yeah. You see Alan Parsons in the movie.
Yeah.
He worked with, he kept working with McCartney and Wings throughout the early 70s, even before his Prague career began.
Yeah.
I guess.
Well, he moved on to Pink Floyd.
Right. That's right. He engineered Dark Side of the Moon, right? So, this all ends when the Alan Klein regime takes over Apple. I mean, one of the
first things they do is murder Magic Alex and put him in a hole.
drop him from a helicopter into the Aegean Sea. Klein was crooked, but he definitely wanted to stop the money faucets. It turned out because he wanted to redirect that money to his accounts.
Right.
But it was, Apple was bleeding money at the time, even if the Eastmans or some third party receiver had taken over. Do you think the Beatles would have survived if not for the money issues?
Oh, no.
I think for many years I thought yes. And now the more I read, I think no.
It's very hard to be in a band, as you know,
I'll take your word for it.
The youngness of people factors into it. The emotional immaturity of being treated like a genius. But also, you see bands all the time break up where they don't need to. That's the thing that it never occurs to anybody, like Prince or Kurt Cobain,
like this should only be the in case of emergency break glass.
Well, and also this whole business of like, you need a record out by Wednesday, like Jimi Hendrix, you need a record out. Like you don't, you could just go. Ringo could miss that recording. You could just take a year off. And the feeling that you have in those moments is, well, if I did that, the whole world would end. If we didn't have a record out by March, the world would come to an end. I'm that much of a central figure. But in fact, because you look at those people, no one ever took a year off, mm-hmm, or even a month off. And now people disappear and you don't hear from them for 5 years. But even now, I think that kind of pressure is on people. If you look at me, I took 14 years off from the music business and the world didn't come to an end.
It's not even, we don't know what the number is, because it ends with a hyphen and then there's no date.
Yeah, that's right.
We don't know what year, is it this year? Is it 2023?
That I come back?
When you finish the record?
It might be. Oh, come on. I've been saying that since 2010, but this might be the year.
I feel like there is an omnibus entry, and maybe someone could tell us which one, where you commit to me, like as if I'm some kind of priest penitent privileged thing,
yeah,
that you will have a record out that year.
And you have not held me to it.
Was I supposed to be your sponsor?
That's why. It's your job.
Like, what am I supposed to do in this world? Like, text you and be like, hey, are you dicking around or are you working on the record?
You do that for like 8 out of 10 other things. You keep me on the rails in every other aspect of my life.
I can start doing that.
But yeah,
should I think, just send empowering messages?
Like, the Beatles didn't realize that if they all want to release solo records, go do it. Go take 4 years and put out All Things Must Pass, and then you don't have to break up, right? Well,
there's the thing we mentioned last week where I think they came very close to that, where they said, look, let's all start doing our own thing.
Yeah.
But we still owe, you know, we just re-upped, we still owe 6 capital, whatever it is, you know, 5 records or whatever. So let's do that. And I think at some point, you know, there's a very hopeful meeting and Lennon plays Cold Turkey.
Yeah.
And the Beatles are like, that's not Beatlesy. You should make that a solo record. What else you got? And he's like, yeah, this is not going to work.
But I think it was Paul that eventually announced it. I don't know. I feel like if George had come out with All Things Must Pass,
yeah,
the Beatles would have gone, actually, George, why don't we make another Beatles record? You know, like they just needed that outlet. But they hated each other too much.
McCartney announced, but he was forced to. Like, I think he had been keeping the secret
for
3 to 6 months that Lennon had said he was done. And I think for legal reasons, because McCartney was going to actually start court proceedings. And I think he needed the Beatles dissolved because he was in this legal bind. The money stuff is terrible, but yeah. I'm with you. I think I understand how they must have just loved the idea of, you know, we never had a normal life and now we're not Beatles. It must have just seemed so great that he could just be shearing sheep in Scotland.
Yeah, I think it was, except none of them really walked away. Paul just got right back. He never wanted to stop being in the Beatles.
He just wanted to, the guys he was ordering around to be Denny Lane and
Session guys. He just wanted people to do what he said. And George just wanted to be in the Beatles. He just wanted to be a full member of the Beatles, considered a full member of the Beatles. And John was on drugs.
Maybe John is the problem at this particular moment.
Yeah, John. But eventually John came back around to just wanting to be in the Beatles, I think, at the end.
The funny thing is that even Magic Alex has a second act. Klein got rid of Magic Alex. I think this is one of the things that he spent years arguing with the papers with. I wasn't fired. I resigned. But it was clear that everybody at Apple was going to have to resign or not or get fired. But he returned as a military defense expert, having turned his amazing inventing workshop powers to.
Did he make a little turbo encabulator that could tell whether he had drugs or not?
Well, what he wants is something that will appeal to celebrities, right? That's what he's good at, schmoozing with celebrities. So he turns his talents to bulletproof cars.
Okay.
We talked about Der Grosser, the Mercedes that became the armored car of choice for dictators and heads of state.
Right.
He decided he was going to make bulletproof vehicles, and he snookers the Greek government basically into backing him financially and saying, this will be great. Greece will begin to export these bulletproof vehicles to various potentates worldwide. The Sultan of Oman and King Hussein of Jordan begin to investigate Alex's limousines. And what they find is that his bulletproof cars are about as reliable as all his other inventions.
They're just protected by lasers.
But this time, lives are on the line.
Right.
You know, like, it's not just a guitar where the neck spins. This time, it's like the Sultan of Oman's, you know, he's got these ex-SAS bodyguards who start shooting at this bulletproof car to see what happens. And in fact, the fuel tank blows up. King Hussein of Jordan has his government investigate whether they should buy some of these things from Greece. And it turns out that not only does the glass break, the armored glass breaks in these incredibly dangerous, jagged formations that are probably more dangerous than a regular automobile.
Yeah, that sounds bad.
At this point, I think at least one of them has actually bought a Magic Alex special from the Greek government. And so the deal says that King Constantine's government is on the hook. So now these guys are going to King Constantine of Greece and being like, hey, these cars are baloney. Where's my $70,000? Uh-huh. Where are my drachmas at? And so just as he maybe never alienated the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles kind of, you know, they would give many interviews over the years about what a crackpot he was. But nobody was ever bitter about Magic Alex, maybe because that was just the water they were swimming in at that time.
How funny was that, Magic Alex. Well, they just, I mean, I guess they weren't actually writing the checks, right?
Apple somewhere is bleeding money.
Yeah.
But
they kind of are like, oh, it's at twice removed.
They don't feel personally bilked. I mean, but they were getting personally lied to by the guy, but maybe they just felt like they got their money's worth in entertainment or the scam victim blames themselves, you know, and never speaks up. Alex died in 2017 in Athens. He was, I think his body was found several days after his death from pneumonia, which probably means he died in kind of a sorry state. But Yoko immediately tweeted, fond reminiscences of Magic Alex, saying he was not just talented, he had a big heart.
Oh.
And I don't know if either of those things seem to be true.
It doesn't sound like either thing is true.
No.
He was, I guess, Team Yoko. I wonder what Cynthia would say.
I mean, Cynthia, having died in 2015, did not outlive Magic Alex. But yeah, I mean, Yoko is now part of a Beatle industrial complex that wants to say nice, heartwarming things that will get a small coterie of fans worldwide to rebuy Rubber Soul in different incarnations. So I think everybody knows what side their bread is buttered on. Maybe nobody will ever actually say what they thought about Magic Alex, but what an act. I think it later turned out that he never, you know, all these things he was saying, he had filed for a bunch of patents and every single one was denied as being derivative or won't work or both. And in fact, he had never had any of the electronics history he had claimed. He was like a TV repairman when he was a kid. And that was how he built a magic box that lights up.
Yeah.
Because he had been fixing, angry old Greek ladies' TVs for a few years before coming to London.
Interestingly, King Constantine just died a couple of months ago.
Really?
He made it all the way to 2023.
What did he put on social when Magic Alex died? Nothing?
I wonder if we can go back and look at Constantine's Twitter account from 2015, maybe.
Because unlike, you know, say Ringo Starr, he actually could have had Alex murdered if he had been so inclined.
Yeah. I mean, maybe he posted a video on his Facebook account of Alex Can't Dance. And that concludes Magic Alex. Magic Alex.
Which Beatle would you say that was?
That was Stoner Bro, not really Beatle. Sorry. Magic Alex. It's always Ringo.
Magic Alex.
Entry 747.JE0708. Certificate number 45939 in the Omni. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. Our handles were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick. Our email address, which was a popular form of written communication.
Droll.
Oh, wait. A popular form of written electronic communication was theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can hang out with other Omnibus fans and argue about our pronunciation of words at Futurelings on the Facebook brand interface, and also anywhere Futurelings congregate.
Anywhere in the metaverse where Futurelings are sold.
Wait a minute, what happens if you just put Futurelings into Google? Have I ever done this?
I think you've done this live during an outro before.
Maybe many times. Futurelings.
You do it every week.
You know, what's funny is, I don't know if I have. The first thing that comes up is Reddit.
Yeah, because there's a subreddit.
And then there is futurelings.com is the second thing that comes up. Facebook is only the third thing.
We should have bought it. Who listening right now is squatting at futurelings.com?
Well, it says official home of the Omnibus Project's Futurelings community
We will pay you £40 a week to become the head of Omnibus Electronics if you will run our website.
And then it goes,
we need more barnacles.
Cotton Bureau is selling Futurelings swag. And then something at goodreads.com.
That's just
is a book group for Futurelings.
Oh, some listener must have started it. Because you can set up book groups there and talk about So somebody must have made a list of books that have been mentioned on the show.
There's Instagram hashtags. And then finally, Omnibus Project, which is our own merchandiser.
We're in the top
store.
10. That's nice.
But what doesn't come up here is Discord and all the other many places that you can hang out. So there's that. You can also mail us things at P.O. Box 55744. Shoreline, Washington, 98155. I heard you opening mail over there.
Well, this one's addressed to you, and it's not really clear if it's for on air.
Is it chocolate? Is it a bomb?
Check and see if that's anthrax or pornography.
Small box. Lots of padding. Opening it up.
Oh, no way.
Wow. Is it for on air? Why don't we let the futurelings decide?
Listen to that.
The dulcet tones. That's not very dulcet, though. It's a little bit.
It's a little flat. We need to tune that.
Yeah, that bell needs a little tuning. That is cool. It is an orange bell.
From whom does it come?
Dear John, I've noticed that you lost your bell around the time you moved, Drew.
That was like 3 years ago.
For me, your orange bell was an important character in your shows. It didn't say a lot, but what it said was important. Mm. How often do you say a thing where I either mime ringing a bell or actually go ding?
Like in real life or on the show?
Well, both.
That's about every 10 minutes.
Yeah, a lot.
In either case.
You have mentioned several times you need your bell, so I wanted to do something to help. They are absolutely correct that this bell came from the old 1970s game Pit. Do you remember Pit?
Yeah. I love Pit.
This is the game. This is the bell from Pit.
So somebody dismantled a game of Pit. They just have a bunch of cow cards or whatever comes in Pit. Hey,
they found a bell from a Pit game, and they say, "I'd be honored if you gave this bell or to give you this bell as a small token." Thank you, Ding. Best regards, Bo Shaw.
Thank you.
Wow, Bo. Now every one of Ken's
we'll call it the
puns
Bo Bell.
Will get a Bo Bell.
I feel like I've given up puns for, I don't know, Lent. Maybe I'm just too old to think of them anymore. I'm getting dumb so fast in a Flowers for Algernon-like way that I can't think of puns anymore.
Is that true? Are you giving your best material to your mainstream audience of olds, and you're coming in here with your second-rate stuff?
Every night on Jeopardy, I do the good Magic Alex material. No, I would never. But... yeah, I don't know. I just feel like you haven't been annoyed at puns lately. Maybe I've just worn you down.
Yeah, that might be it, too. I might be accepting them.
That's nice. That's kind of a new leaf for you.
Futurelings, if you cannot all send orange bells from the 70s game Pit, which I think you all cannot.
No, I think they all could. In fact, why aren't they?
I think...
why has only Bo done this?
Rather than do that, rather than imitate Bo... who lives in Ohio.
Bo knows.
You could subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/theomnibusproject and help support the show. There's lots of great stuff that will come your way as a result, including our Steam. Also, Ken will come to your house and play Scrabble with you.
I will come to your house and do Jeopardy live if you miss it.
So join the gang, join the crowd, and support us on Patreon.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we so fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, these two back-to-back boomer rock recordings, like all our recordings, may be our final word. Wouldn't that be ignominious? I hope the world does not end this week so we can come back and do something sciency before we all die.
Futurelings always will listen in alphabetic order.
That's true. It's true. They will have no idea.
Or they may not have our alphabet, so they'll listen to it in numeric order of...
Maybe of the indexing?
Indexing.
I mean, Saul Zaintz, if you listen to it under Z, will be one of the very last omnibus entries they hear. It'll be that and Zyder Z, and they're out. But if Providence allows, friends, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the omnibus.